There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to this month's minisode of Banging Book Club. This is the fortnightly podcast about books, about sex and gender. I am one of your co-hosts, Lucy Moon, and you'll be hearing Hannah and Lena later in the episode. But I've just edited this one in my bedroom and it's been a really good episode. So this minisode is in response to the book we read last month called Juliet Takes a Breath by Gabby Rivera. It brought up loads of really interesting themes about BAME, womanhood and femininity and LGBTQ plus issues and identity. And it was just a fascinating read. And Hannah, Lena and I thought, well, we can't really speak much more on this topic. And we've just given our thoughts on reading the book. Why don't we invite our audience and other contributors to come and give us their thoughts on white feminism and identity and intersectionality. And so we have had two amazing contributors from our audience come and give us some thoughts. And then we've also had our mate Clarissa and our mate Rowan, who are really interesting and exciting women. Let's begin first by talking about something very exciting that's happening this month in about a week. We, Banging Book Club, are doing our second ever live recording, with the most amazing author whose book we're reading this month, actually. She's called Juno Dawson, and we're reading her new book, The Gender Games. And so we're recording the minisode at this live event. It'd be amazing if you could come along. If you go on Twitter and search at Banging Book Club, there are links where you can buy tickets. And honestly, it's going to be a blast. Like, you're missing out if you don't come. I'm just saying. So yeah, check that out once you listen to the minisode. Right, let's get on to our first contributor. Her name is Nicole.
Hello, Hannah, Lucy, and Lena. I am a bisexual woman from the United States, and I'm really excited to get to respond to you guys' podcast. I'm going to try to keep it brief. First thing off the top, I didn't read the book, so I'm not responding to the text. I'm responding to things that you guys discussed that I thought were interesting. And second thing, I'm recording on a phone, so the recording quality is what it is. I tried, so we'll see how it goes. The first thing I wanted to discuss was the topic regarding the responsibility of authors. I kind of basically agreed with you guys in saying that, yeah, an author is one person. They should try to include other voices and perspectives, but at the end of the day, they're one person, and that's not an issue for me. Again, I'm just speaking for myself, just in case that wasn't clear. But that's not an issue to me. What becomes an issue for me is the way people respond when they are called out for that. So I think responses that are okay are, yes, you're right, I didn't include other voices and perspectives, but here are authors who did, and here are authors from those communities that you're looking to hear from. You know, if you can do that, I think that is stellar. The other thing that I think is great is when people are just like, nope, I didn't include other voices and perspectives. Sorry. And just own it. Like, just own it. And only apologize if you feel inclined to. But if you know you only included one voice and one perspective, stand with that and be okay with that. You know? And when it becomes problematic to me is when there is either a denial of a problem because of one minority voice, which I have seen happen. It's kind of like an author or people who are reading the book, not necessarily the author, but I'm like, oh, I didn't really like this book because I felt like, you know, it was very much for straight white women. No problem with that. I didn't really connect with it. It's kind of like, excuse me, they had one minority voice in there for like two pages. So it's perfect and you need to get over it. And I find that very weird. Like, I don't know. I don't like that response because one minority voice cannot speak for all the varied minority voices out there. Like, that's just not possible. So I think kind of throwing one voice in to just kind of be like, look, I did it, gets kind of offensive. The other thing that I don't necessarily like is when there's a book that, again, is very much for straight white women, because that's just what I'm discussing today, for that audience. I think that's fine. If a book is for the audience, that's fine. You know, no problem with that. The issue I have is when I'm like, oh, I didn't really connect to that book because I am a queer woman of color, so there's just not a lot in there for me. I get a response where people are like, if you just believed hard enough, and if you really wanted to, you could connect with her on every level. You were nitpicking, and she's actually this perfect being who you just need to get on board with. And that happens a lot. Like, I've had a lot of people react that way to my criticisms of books that just aren't meant for me. And I don't mean that offensively when I say I don't relate to something. It's just a fact. And there's just nothing that I feel, nothing that I could do that is going to make my other identities go away. I will relate on some level as a woman, I'm sure, but as a woman of color and as a bisexual woman, there's a lot of times I just don't fully relate and people get really defensive about that. But anyway, I could talk about that all day. So moving on, the other thing I wanted to bring up was the well-intentioned racist that you guys discussed at the end of the podcast. And I thought that was really interesting because I run into that group a lot. And I don't know, it's a group that's really hard to talk to because it's almost as if they have this perspective of either I vote a certain way or I've been to college and I'm educated, or I have like three friends that are minorities and I live in a very liberal area, so there's nothing you can tell me about racism. And it really is fascinating, almost as fascinating as it is disheartening, because when you try to call out microaggressions in that group, very often people kind of respond to like, why are you nitpicking? We live in this great place or work in this great place, or we are a great friend group where nobody is racist, where nobody is homophobic. So there's nothing wrong with us. We're not like them, the others with Confederate flags and hate groups. Therefore, we are above it. And if you were pointing anything out, it's because you're just trying to disrupt the peace. And it's weirdly almost easier to have a real conversation with someone who wears their heart on their hate on their sleeve, like a Confederate flag. So I can be like, hey, Confederate flags are offensive. No, it's not. It's whatever. And I'm like, well, I think this 'cause this. Well, I think they're fine because whatever. And we can have it back and forth. But when I try to bring up people that are like really liberal, or they feel as if they're above racism or above homophobia, they're just kind of like, you're wrong, you're nitpicking, I clearly didn't mean it that way, you're just trying to make me feel bad, or you're just trying to cause problems, you're just trying to stir the pot, and things like that. That being said, I really admire you guys because, like, I literally laughed so hard when the podcast was starting, and I think Lena had said, are we racist? I thought that was super funny because it's just refreshing. My guests just question it sometimes. You know, everyone has implicit bias. Everyone commits microaggressions no matter what group you are from, you know, and I think it's important to constantly reevaluate. I do that myself as a woman of color and as a bisexual woman. I'm sure there are still things I do towards other groups that aren't fair, that I'm not aware of. And if I get called out on it, I need to go, hold on a minute, let me digest that and let me think. And I think that it's really admirable that you guys are constantly willing to expose yourself to different perspectives, but also turn it back on yourselves and go, oh, what more can we do? Or how often do we do this? Or how much more can we learn? And I just think that's just awesome. And it's a big part of why I enjoy listening to your podcast. So thank you three for being my least problematic faves. You guys are great. And I really look forward to your next episode. Thanks. Bye.
And now on to our second contributor, Lerato.
Hi, I'm Lerato, and I'm 18, and this book changed my life. It was incredible. I've never read a book that was so self-affirming, and I've never had the chance to relate to a character quite as much as I related to Juliet. This book captured what it's like experiencing that kind of white lady, vagina-focused feminism when you just don't or can't relate, and it captured what it's like to fall in love with a girl, and it captured what it's like to be terrified to come out even if you know your family loves you, and what it's like to be an outsider pretty much everywhere. And that was probably one of my favorite themes explored in this book. Juliet felt like an outsider in Portland due to her sexuality, but also race-wise, she felt like a, I quote, white girl with brown skin. And this was just after Fenn had questioned whether she was really gay. She questions whether she's Puerto Rican enough. And that's such a common feeling within both the BME and the LGBT plus community, but it's not really talked about all that much. You asked if this was a coming of age or a coming of queer story, and I think that's really interesting because I personally don't see a distinction in the two. There is so much overlap whether you figure out your sexuality or gender at 12 or 20 or like 68. I feel like they're so similar that this is both a coming of age and a coming of queer story, and they're essentially the same thing. I devoured this book. I read it in 2 days, and then I made all my other friends read it. Ava, and kind of interned this book, Ava's like basically my favorite character. She was kind of like a literary big sister I would have really benefited from at 14, and I definitely recommend this book to any kid that's struggling with their sexuality or struggling with where they fit in as like a first, second generation immigrant. And it was super valuable to me. Like, now I've never had a book that told me it was okay to be queer and brown and to question white feminism, and that was bloody incredible.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And then Lena sat down with our friend Clarissa to talk more about this in depth.
Cool. Well, Lucy should have already done an intro, haven't you, Lucy? So I'm just going to like pop into it. Hi, Clarissa.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
This is my friend Clarissa, guys. Everyone bow down.
Hi.
She's fucking amazing. So I've given you three questions.
You were doing
some homework.
I'm very impressed. Yeah.
So the first question I wanted to ask you was, what does intersectional feminism mean to you?
So yeah, in terms of my identity, I am a 26-year-old
black woman. I went to state school. I was also educated at Oxford University. I'm able-bodied, I'm cisgender, I'm straight, and I'm from North London. And sort of as I was saying, although it's kind of intersectionality for me personally isn't inherently about identity, I think, you know, outlining some of the things that make you who you are, like, is really telling about then, like, what you think about feminism and, like, what you think about intersectionality. So, obviously, like, the way I just described myself was really reductive. But I wanted to do that to, like, illustrate how if one or more of those parts of my identity were to change, so would my experience and therefore, like, so would my perspective. And so the new Clarissa that would be, like, different from the one I just spoke about would
be equally subjective.
Absolutely. And would have, like, a completely different experience and a completely different perspective. And I think that's when we start to get into, like, problems and like people can be seen as problematic because that isn't acknowledged. So I think if, you know, when we don't acknowledge that people can have different experiences and different perspectives, that's when we get into things like intersectional kind of erasure and intersectional discrimination. So for me, like, intersectional feminism is feminism. Like, the only kind of feminism I personally identify with is intersectional. And like, lots of my friends and lots of the people that I admire kind of, like, espouse kind of intersectionality, and I think that they do acknowledge that people will in, like, necessarily have different experiences, right? And we can't talk in a really blanket statement way about people. And I think it's really important to remember that, because, like, intersectional erasure is, like, a real thing, and people are experiencing it, like, people have experienced it. And I think if the world is going the way it's going, like, people will, like, continue to do it until that's kind of addressed. So I personally find Kimberly Crenshaw's definition of intersectionality as the most useful for me when we're talking about that, because it speaks to my experience and my perspective. So, like, for those people who don't know who she is.
I don't know who she is.
Yeah, so she's a
Tell
G.
Me.
She's a G. That's the first thing. Can we just put that out there? She's like a
That's
G.
like definition one.
She's a G. Like, she's a goddess. She's amazing. She's this African-American woman. She's an academic. She's a feminist critical race theorist. And she was the one who actually first introduced this idea of intersectionality, and she was initially talking about it in relation to the law and black women and how things were affecting them in a different way from white women and black men, which is traditionally how, when you think of a black woman, you know, again, people try to compartmentalize identity and they say, oh, well, there's a black bit, we can relate that to, like, being a black man, and there's a woman bit, so, like, that's defined in terms of a white woman. And she was kind of saying that actually there's a kind of a different space that these people occupy. So how I kind of interpret what she talked about intersectionality was that she kind of described intersectionality as almost like social injustice and oppression are like a matrix, and like, social injustice can overlap at times and create, like, really specific, like, unique and multiple kind of forms of kind of social injustice. So, like, if you think about things like racism, sexism, ageism, like, ableism, like, all the different isms, and, like, all the, you know, Islamophobia, fatphobia, like, all the different, like, phobias, think about all those things, and this gives us a framework for understanding that people can experience all those things, or one or more of those things, all at the same time.
Oh yeah, so do you ever think that the term is misused, overused, underused? Or should, like, can we, my question, I guess, is, like, can we ever get to a point where we don't need to use the term intersectional feminism? Because
Internet feminism.
The lesson is, intersectional feminism is intellectual feminism.
It is.
Like, yeah, I don't know. Do you ever get fed up with the term, or, like, that we're still using it, or is it still, like, a useful term?
I think it's really, I think it's really useful. Like, I think, obviously, like, I would say historically it has been misused. So, like, I think in terms of what I was saying about identity, I think sometimes when people hear the word, like, intersectionality, they automatically think about, like, identities, and it's about, like, counting how many you have and like how acutely you might experience. It's actually not about how acutely you might experience social injustice or oppression because of that identity, but it's just like, this is your identity. And that's, we can talk about it like that. But I think, it's been historically misused and underused. But I think now, because of like social media, because of the way in which traditionally marginalized voices actually are creating spaces for themselves, and there are lots of, you know, there's lots of kind of activism that is happening online and offline that's just more visible. I think this word is coming more to the forefront, and I'd really love to see like more discussions incorporate it, because especially like I think especially so obviously I'm black, and often when we talk about like critical race theory or issues to do with black people, and often black people, we're often talking about men indirectly because of patriarchy and how they also like end up dominating that discussion. And we're not talking about women, and then we're not talking about black British women, right? So like, do you know what I mean? I think so, because of the internet and like the way in which different people do have a platform, we're seeing things that are really localized, like specific to like where you live, and people talking about those experiences, and that's really important. So I think and that's what intersectional feminism is about, like how localized those experiences are. And we just need more, like we need more. And in the same way that like if you talk about women's fiction or women's writing, like we've had this, you could talk about the history of like English literature or literature and the canon and how women have traditionally been excluded from that. So we've got a whole many hundreds of years of that happening. So in the same way, like when we're talking about feminism and intersectional feminism, we've only had like we've had a bit of a period where that hasn't been used. So we do really need to, I think, reclaim it and bring it like to the forefront.
So for a Becky like me, am I allowed to call it Becky?
You're not Becky. You are not the focus of Lemonade.
As a white woman. Actually, the funniest part of that is woman. I'm definitely a girl. Yeah, that's true.
Stop it.
Like,
I love Lemonade.
Like, do you have any like do's or don'ts or examples of like things that like I could potentially get wrong or maybe have been getting wrong? I mean, you tell me.
Yeah, I think you're amazing. I think you're brilliant, and you know how much I love you. So I don't want to, I mean, yeah, this question, I think do's are always really helpful. I think I think don'ts are important, but you can reframe a don't as a do, right?
Yeah.
So I think do always be listening. That's really great. I think I've been in situations where, you know, people are not listening and you're kind of spoken about, or like when you're in the room and like, so I think it's just really important to listen, and again, like, think about where you're coming from, think about your perspective like in relation to other people. I think it's really important to include different voices, like as you're doing. I think, as I said, I think that's brilliant, including different voices, but including like many different voices, so that we don't get someone monopolizing the conversation. I think is just as more people and more different kinds of people is really good, because yeah, as we've said, their experiences are different. So I think as well, like, do like think about your life, like think about the positions of power that you kind of have and how you can like affect them. And we can all do things that are big and small, you know, like it doesn't have to be huge. You don't have to lead a march or a movement in that way, but there are things that we're doing that we can just be a bit more mindful and think about, including other people. If you haven't done anything wrong or problematic, like, do you know what I mean? Like, why you have to question why you react in that way sometimes, I think. Not you personally, but why people do. And is that coming from a place of guilt or shame, or what is happening there?
Well, like also just like this resistance to change. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you don't disrupt me. I'm doing my own shit. And that's not, you need to be willing,
Yeah, it's cool.
Have you ever played Bop It?
What's that?
You know, like, bop it, move it, pull it, and it's like a game that you pass around. It's like an advert. Game.
I feel like I saw that, like, back in the day.
But, like, if you lost the game, then the game goes, do it again, but better. And it always reminds me of that. I'm like, I understand, but more.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you for talking to us.
And finally, our mate Rowan came on and spoke to Hannah about all sorts of other fun things.
So I have our friend Rowan Ellis with me.
Hi, everyone.
Hey. So you read the blurb for Juliet and you just listened to our podcast about it.
Yeah, and immediately messaged you being like, what is this book? Why haven't I heard about it? I need to read it right now.
Are you going to go and read it then?
Yeah,
100%. Yeah. Oh, okay. So what do you think in general, just first thoughts about intersectionality in the book, and is that anything that you've come across in like YA literature before?
Not necessarily something that I feel like I've come across in a lot of writing before, actually. I feel like intersectionality, which I think I talked about on the podcast, is something that isn't necessarily a new concept. Even I feel like people were kind of feeling it before it got named even, but I think when you've had a lot of minorities who have been like segregated off, or you know, kind of not able to be out, like queer people, or haven't had their voices heard independently, like disabled people, it's been difficult to get to that point where enough people come together. And I feel like the internet has been like a massive draw together and a huge boom in intersectional feminism, which
the internet is how I heard about intersectionality in the first place. And like I think the term was coined in the 70s or 80s or something, like quite a while ago, at least in academia. But it's only in the last few years that I've learnt about it. Well, what does intersectional feminism mean to you?
So I think intersectional feminism is not necessarily a solid state of being that you like pass or fail at. Mm-hmm. I think that it's an attitude towards the world that acknowledges the kind of institutional oppression that people face, and the kind of difficulties that might put in front of them, or the circumstances that they might have in their lives, potentially because of that other groups would not have, or would have in a different way. And in doing so, you're able to practice feminism in a way that understands that you're going to have to account for those things in order to fight towards equality for everyone.
So kind of like step one is just being aware of the fact that everyone's got different experiences, depending on what kind of like what a minority they might belong to.
Yeah, so you can want to practice intersectional feminism, and I feel like a lot of people probably did. And before the internet, I'm sure a lot of people thought like, oh yeah, I want to help all women. But I feel like those experiences, the very nature of privilege means that you don't know how good you have it in a lot of ways when you have it. You don't know you have privilege when you have it. And so I can definitely see how you can have situations where people are often in the same geographical location, which often means they're with the same class of people. In the UK, for example, class is like a massive thing, which in turn can sometimes have an influence on racial aspects, which can in turn have an influence on as sexuality, whether people come out to you, whether they feel safe, all this kind of stuff. So actually just getting to a point where you have enough voices in your life who are telling you, yeah, you might want to help black women, but like as a black woman, this is the way in which my life goes. It might be different to yours. This is a way in which you can be a feminist who stands up for black women as well as white women. But you can have the intentions, but if you don't know those experiences other people have, it can be very difficult to implement them. So I have a little bit of a sticking point with the term white feminism.
Sure.
Because
what
I
do
think
we call
it? I think it's very useful as a term for white women who centre white women's voices exclusively or overwhelmingly, or who don't consider other women's voices. I think it becomes a much more difficult label to give to the idea of also bringing disability and also bringing like sexuality and gender identity into it. Not because I'm like, oh no, white, you can't call it white, you have to call it white strip, whatever.
Yeah.
But it means that I think there's this assumption that the people who are going to not center kind of black and Asian women, for example, will also not center LGBT, and that's somehow like a this and the us and them situation. Whereas I think you can absolutely have a situation where there's a black woman who doesn't center disabled women in her feminism. And like, what do you call that woman? Like, I think that there needs to,
or what you call
we
that
need
feminism.
Yeah, like a non-intersectional feminist, like, and I think that discussion is a little bit more nuanced than just like white women are the only women who aren't intersectional.
Do you ever think that the term intersectional is misused or overused or underused?
So I think that a lot of people would say if someone does something that they see as non-intersectional and they call themselves an intersectional feminist, then immediately the idea is like they aren't an intersectional feminist and they've used that word wrong. I would say it's not the making the mistake, it's the reaction to making the mistake, which maybe proves whether someone's an intersectional feminist.
Sure, that either if they own up or... Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so if they take responsibility, if they change their pattern of behaviour, if they are learning and see... Because no one suddenly says, I'm going to be an intersectional feminist, I know everything. Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't mm-hmm. happen. And people are still learning, and especially in communities which are reasonably young, so like the LGBT community as it is now, with the inclusion of trans people properly into the community, which, to be honest, the amount of transphobia in the LGBT community means that, like, has that even happened yet? Mm-hmm. And the amount of like racism in the LGBT community and all this kind of stuff means that we're still going through that process as a community. And so, like, I remember when I was at university, the community was called something different. No one knew what LGBT meant when I was 18. Like, that wasn't a thing that most people I knew had come across, whereas now it's, like, everywhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and also, like, it went through a load of different iterations even when I was at uni. So everyone was changing their stash and their logos constantly because it was, like, LGBT. No, it has to be LGBT star because we don't want people to think transgender means just people who are binary and transitioning right. from one to the other, as it were. But instead it can encompass all these other kind of identities. No, we have to put LGBT plus, star plus. No, we have to add the Q in there. And, like, even when I was at uni, it was changing. And, like, I was, president of my LGBT society. And I was kind of... So it made sense that I was keeping up with this stuff. But why would some random, like, 30-year-old gay guy be, like, into the politics of, like, what our community is called or not mm-hmm. when it's not a conversation that the mainstream is having? You have to search it out. So it's kind of like, I don't blame anyone for believing in the tenets of intersectionality and wanting to practice it, but not being perfect. I think it's that idea, which I think is everyone wants to be right. And so it does take a lot of like humility and self-reflection to be called out on something and be like, you're right. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to change that.
And kind of like, it doesn't matter what the specific situation is, mm-hmm. like being called out is like a horrible experience, even if you are wrong.
Yeah,
you're just that, and that bridge that you have to cross to kind of, and you know, with social media, like publicly, also kind of be like, I'm sorry, I was wrong, I'll do better.
Yeah,
like that seems really easy. We make it sound like all you have to do is apologize, and it's really easy. La 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 la.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's particularly scary because a lot of the internet don't like to forget.
Yeah.
The wrongs that you've done in the past, yeah. even if you've done like good since then, and then you make one more mistake and then everyone's dragging up your mistakes yeah. from a few years ago or whatever it is.
Yeah, so which I really don't like. I feel like people have made mistakes years ago but have clearly not learned from it and continue to make them and don't like to admit that they're wrong and won't apologize, like that's very different. But if there's someone who's made a mistake a long time ago but has tried to make amends, has tried to learn, has been seeking out information and kind of own voices to like mm-hmm. learn about stuff, who is not making those mistakes again, who has rectified it, who has, you know, if they've made a problematic video, has deleted the video so that misinformation can't continue to be spread, for example, like from a call out like YouTube point of view or a Tumblr post or whatever sure. it is that they've done that exists on its own on the internet that people can find and learn that misinformation, that there is some kind of re-education where they upload a different video or a different Tumblr post which has correct information on it, for example. You know, all these things are things that can be done that are actually working towards true intersectionality.
So for straight women,
yeah,
do you have any do's or don'ts in terms of them trying to be helpful or when they think they're helping but they're unintentionally being dicks, and like what's their place in helping?
So I think that there's a real interesting situation with like queer people, which is that one, you can't tell people are queer by looking at them, and a lot of minorities will have people within the community that's the same for, like you have invisible disabilities, for example, where yeah. you can be like, you can look at someone and be like, you are in a wheelchair, therefore I can associate you with this thing automatically. And then there are people who are deaf where it's like, oh okay, cool, I literally had no idea.
Yeah.
And similarly, you have the idea of like white passing people of colour and stuff like that. Whereas with LGBT stuff, it's pretty much impossible from the outset unless we're wearing like a badge to be like, yes, this person is 100%
just wearing
this
a rainbow
thing.
Flag.
Exactly. Which is why like I have the backpack that I carry around has like literally got rainbow patches and like feminist patches and queer patches all over it, because I do feel kind of a weird element of like this thing that's so in kind of integral to me not being on display in some way, like being kind of erased just by the fact that I'm like a very feminine,
like a
woman, that's like
part
assumed
of your identity is invisible.
Yeah, exactly. But because of that, it means that our community is very disparate, and there's no community centres, there's no, like, the only real kind of hub of community is like 18 plus
alcohol.
Bars of alcohol, mm-hmm. Pretty much only for men, and then those communities have their own issues with racism or with ableism, which means that there's a load of men who might otherwise be able to go to these places who don't feel welcome. We don't have any kind of like community leaders who are like voices of the community to rally around, like that. It's an interesting situation in that we don't kind of have a central point with which to kind of have these discussions,
mm-hmm.
and so it feels really interesting talking to straight and cis people about stuff like this, because it feels like we don't have consensus in our own community about things. So like, people will come to me and be like, is it okay for me to use the word queer? And I'm like, well,
yeah,
that's all can of worms, my friend.
Sure. Yeah.
But it is a reason why it's really difficult to just tell people like, go and read about it, because there are so many differing opinions and kind of misinformation and all this kind of stuff out there, that actually you kind of have to do the education right now, because there's no education in schools. There's
yeah.
no, like, we don't learn about LGBT history in schools at all. We don't learn about LGBT heroes. We don't learn about, like, it's not something that people have any access to. So actually, like, people who are around now in the age of the internet are kind of doing the education for them. So it's like, for me, it's just like, ask. If you're like a straight person and you don't know something, as long as it's like a respectful question, ask. And if it's not a respectful question, or it's none of your business, then don't. Like, especially
yeah.
around like trans people, for example, talking about their bodies, just don't ask. It's none of your business. It's like, if you wouldn't ask it to anyone else, don't ask it to them. So it's really, it's a difficult one, because I think there's so, in terms of like advice for straight people, because there's so many things, you'd have to like almost have specific examples of like what can be done, because I think we live in such a heteronormative society that there's such overwhelming assumptions that like everything is straight.
Yeah.
That it can be really hard to kind of like even unlearn or think about that. Don't assume everyone's straight is a pretty important one.
Yeah.
Which I am guilty of, which I've done before, because
no,
I'm so used to being around LGBT people who are very open, that if someone doesn't come out to me when I come out to them, I'm like, automatically in my head, I'm like, cool, they're
yeah.
straight.
No,
or like, they're in the closet, so they won't tell me, as opposed to like, oh, they're just not the kind of person who says this to someone straight away.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Rowan.
Thanks for having me.
Rowan also has a YouTube channel. If you search Rowan Ellis, you'll be able to find it. Yeah, thank you so much. Hearing everyone's opinions was super, super interesting, and hearing thoughts. And I feel a lot wiser and more educated. Anyway, thank you so much, everyone who contributed. Thank you, everyone who shared their thoughts on Twitter, and everyone who listened to the podcast. We will see you in a fortnight.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.